Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. So on the line, we have our friend Thomas Mountain, and he writes for Counterpunch. And we had him on last week, and then we had telephone difficulties. He writes from Eritrea in Eastern Africa. And unfortunately, we lost the phone call, and we're unable to finish the interview. But now's our chance to follow up, and with a whole bonus segment, too. So right on. Welcome back to the show. Thomas, how are you?
Good.
Very happy to have you here. Now, so I lost you right when we were coming back from break last week, and the question at the time was, I was hoping that you could fill me in about the Amoros, I think is how you say it, from the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, because you know, we had talked about how when the famine hit in 2011, especially, how the Somalis were hit hardest of all because of the American war there had turned the whole society upside down, so the famine was just hitting them on top of that. And you mentioned about in the Ogaden region how they had suffered just as bad because there was a civil war going on in Ethiopia where the Ethiopia wasn't just fighting the Somalis at the time. They were, continually persecuting the Amoros and disrupting their civilization so bad that they were suffering the same problem as the Somalis, not just the unrelenting heat and drought, but also the complete disruption of their markets and their ability to trade and feed each other.
Well, the Ogaden region is actually populated by the Somali people, but they don't consider themselves part of Somalia. They consider themselves an independent region called the Ogaden. Next door to the west, in the south, is the Oromo people, which actually make up at least half of some 40 million Ethiopians.
Oh, okay. I had my regions and ethnic groups wrong there. Please, thank you for clarifying
well,
that.
Well, the Oromos actually were suffering from the drought, too. Not all of them, but the ones in the south were suffering from the drought. But this is the worst drought in 60 years. And the Oromos have been in the news more recently, because there's been a big, there was an explosion amongst the Oromos because the Ethiopian regime had been taking their land and turning it over to foreign investors and carrying out a lot of nasty policies against the Oromos as well. But the Ogaden is where the armed struggle has been pretty unrelenting now. It came in the news in 2007 when the Chinese tried to come in and drill for oil and natural gas in the Ogaden National Liberation Front, which is the rebels fighting the Ethiopian regime, warned the Chinese off. The Chinese didn't listen, and they attacked the Chinese drilling outfit and killed about 12 Chinese and as well as several hundred Ethiopian guards. So at that point, the Ethiopian government went crazy because Ethiopia imports all of their fuel. And it, by some accounts, up to 75% of their foreign currency goes to pay for their fuel needs. If they could get some fuel, natural gas or oil coming out of the Ogaden, which is reported to be quite rich in energy resources, then that could solve their problem or go a long way to solving their problem. And when the Ogaden fighters put a stop to that, the Ethiopian government clamped a complete food and aid, a medical aid embargo on the region and started carrying out a scorched earth policy. And so fast forward to the 2011-2012 drought, the worst drought and famine in 60 years, the Ethiopian government had even kicked the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders. Now, what country in the world we know of has kicked out both the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders in the midst of the worst famine and drought in 60 years? And yet, nothing was said in the West. I mean, the fact is, Enough Project, headed by someone I call Obama's quiet consigliere, Gail Smith, a very quiet senior member of the White House intelligence staff, was head of in opposition to the Bush regime at the time, and it founded this organization called Enough Project, today headed by John Prendergast. And they had actually written about the scorched earth policies of the Ethiopian regime in the Ogaden. And then, of course, when Obama came to power and she became a senior member of the Obama administration, Enough Project shut up completely about this Ogaden genocide. Now, when I say genocide, actually, I'm not the only one that's labeled them this. The International Federation of Jurists has called it a genocide and called in the International Criminal Court to prosecute the Ethiopian regime for carrying out a genocide during the worst, by applying this food and medical aid embargo on the region during the worst drought and famine in 60 years. So, but see, the thing is, whenever we talk about the East Africa, the Horn of Africa, whenever there's a major problem, you can just about guarantee the Ethiopian regime is behind it. And I mentioned briefly last time about how the problems in South Sudan are based in Addis Ababa, that this Riek Machar, who is the so-called rebel chief, is actually being supported by the Ethiopian regime. And because Ethiopia is a client state of the United States, and the United States wants to see China kicked out of Sudan, the Sudanese oil fields, which is the only Chinese-owned and controlled oil fields in Africa. Mm-hmm. The United States gets about half of its imported oil from Africa, and it's in the U.S. national interest to deny access to African oil and energy to the Chinese. And the Sudanese oil fields is Chinese's only major majority-owned involvement there. The United States wants China out. The only beneficiary of this horrible civil war that's going on in South Sudan, with its thousands of innocents being massacred, this huge famine resulting as coming about right now as I speak, because the people have been driven off their land and had no food because they couldn't plant in the rainy season, is the only beneficiary is the United States. And the United States policemen, the one that's their thug that does the dirty work for the U.S. in the region, is the Ethiopian regime, which has been carrying out a genocide in the Ogaden and now is involved in Sudan, in South Sudan. And it's called an open secret out here. I've interviewed a number of diplomats from Uganda and Kenya. The chief of staff of the Eritrean government has come on and said, this is an open secret. Ethiopia is behind this war in South Sudan. Mm. Everybody looks at Africans killing Africans when it's actually United States. The United States wants to get rid of the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, because he continues to work with the Chinese and continues to support the Chinese in their attempts to reopen the oil fields in Sudan. The United States wants to get rid of him, and they want to install their boy Riek Machar. Riek Machar is not new to all these massacres. Way back in 1991, he was carrying out big massacres. And I recently saw an Al Jazeera interview from 3 or 4 years ago where they asked Riek Machar about the 1991 massacres he carried out, and he, in the exact same words that he's using today to deny involvement in the massacres in South Sudan. So this is a huge problem that we're having here in the Horn of Africa, where Ethiopia was the one that destroyed the Union of Islamic Courts peace initiative that brought peace to the Mogadishu for the first time in 15 years. Now it's Ethiopia that's brought civil war to South Sudan. Ethiopia did invade Eritrea in 2000. There's this huge enemy of the people of Africa that's centered in Addis Ababa, and yet we have that former prime minister of Ethiopia, the guy that launched this genocidal aid and medical embargo on the Ogaden, Meles Zenawi, when he passed away, who's eulogizing him?
Susan Rice. All right, now hold it right there, Thomas. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Thomas Mountain after this. Check him out at counterpunch.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Of course, I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. Talking with Thomas Mountain from Eritrea. Well, he's an American in Eritrea. And we're talking about America's support for all kinds of death and destruction across East Africa, and at the hands of our sock puppet proxies in Ethiopia. First of all, in South Sudan, I know that for years and years, America supported the South in the civil war there. And it was, clearly, for, more than a decade, it's been on the record in, the New York Times version of history and everything, that the South is where the oil is, and it's also where the black Christians and animists are. And so you could conceivably, you can use that as a pretext to break it off from the rest of Sudan, which is Arab and Muslim, and call it a new state. And then, as you said, to keep China out. Or keep that oil either off the market or pumping this way if it gets going anywhere. But now, so you're talking about a further level of intervention since the successful secession of South Sudan from the rest of Sudan. Now there's a civil war that's broken out. And according to, the NPR version of the story, it's a tribal difficulty. And I don't know if it's the majority or the minority who supposedly control the capital and the rest want to share power. And so now it's a big civil war within the new state. And what you're telling me is no, because the Ethiopians, at the behest of the Americans, are backing one side against the other. So can you talk about the Minka men and the different tribes and who's on whose side and how exactly this works a little bit for us, please?
Sure. Some little bit of background. The man that's considered the founding father of South Sudan is John Garang. And John Garang, interestingly enough, was vehemently opposed to the independence of South Sudan. Way back in 2005, John Garang, after the peace deal was signed between the Bashir government and the South Sudanese People's Liberation, South Sudan People's Liberation Movement, headed by John Garang, he came to his Khartoum and spoke in front of a crowd of over 1 million people. And President Bashir, the biggest crowd he ever pulled, was about 100,000. John Garang spoke to over 1 million people. And what did he say? He said that he was against South Sudanese independence. He said that we're going to have one Sudan, there was equal rights and justice for all Sudanese with John Garang as the president. He was going to running for president in the next election. And also he said they were going to have an independent foreign policy and they weren't going to work with the Western exploitation regimes. They were going to work with the Chinese and come in and try to set up some sort of partnership with the Chinese and develop an independent economy. And within just a matter of weeks, John Garang was dead. So John Garang, the father of independent South Sudan, was actually against South Sudanese independence. So that should tell you that there were storm clouds that gathered over South Sudan before it was even born. And then I had an article predicting all the present outbreak of violence 2 years ago when I said that the U.S. planned to destabilize Sudan. When I wrote about how the United States wanted the Chinese out and how the United States was going to foment a crisis in the country. But they managed the South Sudanese and the Sudanese managed to patch things back up, get the oil, Chinese oil flowing again. And then we had this so-called coup led by Riek Machar, who's from a minority tribe called the Nuer. And the president of South Sudan is from the majority tribe called the Dinka, and his name is Salva Kiir. Salva Kiir was the head of the military under John Garang that fought against the Bashir government. And he became, after John Garang's mysterious death, he became the new president of South Sudan. Well, when they finally have independence. So you have, the conflict is based among ethnic groups. But the question is, the reports coming out now that tens of millions of dollars worth of weapons are pouring into South Sudan. And where are those weapons coming from? Who's paying for all that? The oil fields are shut down. How is Riek Machar's army and his ethnic-based army paying their bills? How is he getting ammunition? Where is he getting the money from? That's the question that's not being, show me the money. The question is not being asked. Okay, where's this funding coming from? So it's become an open secret. The Ethiopians are supporting him. Now, like I mentioned, Ethiopia has an ongoing energy crisis. They're hemorrhaging foreign currency to pay for their fuel import. Now, the Brazilians have promised to build a railroad from Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, to the western border in Gambela, where there's large amounts of oil, underground oil, and the Gambela fields are linked into the South Sudanese fields geologically, and you can transport oil via railroad cars. And if the Ethiopians are able to come in and get a hold of the Sudanese oil, then they could solve this major problem. And so they have their own axe to grind in this conflict. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the United States is paying something like $3 billion a year in aid to Ethiopia. I mean, Ethiopia, it's a well-kept secret. Ethiopia is the most aid-dependent country in the world. Ethiopia's export bill last year was something like, I mean, they had about $2.1 or $2.2 billion coming in exports for a country of 80 million people. And the import bill was over $11 billion. So it's something like $9 billion a year. Nobody explains where that money's coming from. It's keeping the Ethiopian regime afloat.
Well, and not only that, but keeping them in occupation as they've reinvaded Somalia and are occupying Somalia, which is costing $1 zillion a day. Obviously, it's the American taxpayer that's picking up that's pushing the tab for all of this, whether we know it or not. That's really something else. And my apologies here in my ignorance. I got fooled by the headline here. Minkamin is a place, of course, in South Sudan. I know nothing about it. So it's the Nuer and the Dinka are the groups that are fighting. But as you're saying, and which side is it that's backed by the Ethiopians? Or they're just trying to destabilize the whole situation?
Rick Machar is from the Nuer tribe. And historically, the Nuer and the Dinka have been at each other's throats. Back in 91, Rick Machar led a Nuer massacre of a lot of Dinkas. The Nuers live around the oil fields, along the border, the Abyei region, along the border between North and South Sudan. Yeah, so something other interesting people don't realize, the extent the United States is actually trying to, it's not just divide and rule, it's actually a crisis management. The United States prefers to create crisis and then manage these crises to better loot and plunder the resources of the area. The United States doesn't want to see African countries cooperating and working together, and I'll give you a prime example. Ethiopia is building a giant new dam called the Renaissance Millennium Dam that's going to dam up the historic waters of the Nile River, and it's threatening Egypt's very survival, because if that dam fills up, Egypt's going to lose 20 or 30% of their water, which they need desperately to keep their country afloat. I mean, just to feed the country, let alone create electricity to keep the people alive. So, now this dam is going to produce 6,000 megawatts of electricity. Well, right presently, 75% of Ethiopia, 60 million people, have no electricity. So, there's no budget to bring electricity to these people. And yet this big dam is being built, with 6,000 megawatt dam, and by estimates is the most Ethiopia could use, even if they put electricity in for the 60 million people that don't have it, would be 2,000 megawatts. So why is Ethiopia building a big dam, blocking off the Nile River, creating a conflict with Egypt? Egypt's going to launch a war against Ethiopia if this dam goes into effect. And Ethiopia doesn't even need the electricity. They only can use a third of the electricity being generated. Well, lo and behold, who is the ones that started the brainchild of this dam was? The World Bank, 51% owned by the USA. So now the USA has got two of their client states, Ethiopia and Egypt, even though Egypt may be less and less of a client state these days, at each other's throats, threatening war, rather than working together and developing economic partnership and developing independence and self-sustainability apart from Western economic domination.
Right.
So, we every time we turn around and we see a problem, who's behind the problem? Who's actually the one that pushed this brainchild, that pushed the creation of this dam in the first place, a dam that Ethiopia could, the electrical needs of Ethiopia could easily be met by smaller dams on tributaries to the Nile and not threaten Egypt's access to that water.
Yeah,
and
that's what they did in Sri Lanka.
All the water, electricity they need.
Yeah, that's the same thing they did in Sri Lanka in the book By Way of Deception. There's a big IMF boondoggle and just served to split the population and set them at war. Make a bunch of money in that case for the Israelis. I don't know if they're in on this one or not, but same old scam, it sounds like.
Well, that's the thing. So, when I tell people anything you read, don't trust anything you read about the Horn of Africa and almost nothing you see, whenever you take a deep look at what's really going on in the Horn of Africa and the conflicts that are going on, the major conflicts, inevitably you see a foreign hand in all of this. And then you want to blame Africans for being savages that are just incapable of living together in peace, and it's just tribal violence and bloodshed, and it's all just big chaos and famine and war, and this is just inherent to the black savages in Africa. Well, there's somebody behind all of this, and I think that's something I really have come to appreciate the Scott Horton show, because he's one of the very few voices out there that's willing to have this sort of a viewpoint put out there. And I want to tell all your listeners out there, you guys have got to, you know, dig deep in these hard times and donate to the Scott Horton Show, because otherwise there's these huge crimes that are going on about that we're just not going to hear. And I got to say this, even though it may sound a bit harsh, in the middle of the summer of 2011, as the worst drought and famine in Somalia and the Horn of Africa was beginning to rage, and hundreds of people were dying every day in the outskirts of Mogadishu, an award-winning journalist named Jeremy Scahill landed in Mogadishu, and the result of which he wrote a groundbreaking expose about not the famine that was taking hundreds of lives a day, ended up taking 250,000 lives. He wrote about the drone program and the assassination drone program and a supposedly secret CIA prison there, and, you know, whether it was intentional or not, and I don't know how he missed the fact that within a few miles of the hotel he was staying, hundreds of people were dying every day from a Western-imposed famine. You know, we had a smokescreen that pointed everybody off into this drone where, you know, hundreds of people were assassinated by the drone program. The fact is that at least 250,000 Somalis died, and maybe a couple hundred thousand Somalis in the Ogaden died, and not a mention of this in anything. So, you know, the Scott Horton Show is about one of the few places that you're actually going to hear about this on the radio, and your listeners have got to get behind Scott, because I know life must be tough for independent journalists like you.
Well, you know, at the time, I actually was talking with Leslie Lefkow from Human Rights Watch, and she was doing great work on the famine there. And, you know, I'll give Jeremy credit, because I think he does the best job of any Western reporter so far of putting in a nutshell in his article, Blowback in Somalia. He's got maybe one or two big paragraphs where he really goes point by point by point. This is how America intervened and escalated and escalated and escalated and escalated. And you're right that it's like a mortal sin, the omission, apparently by ignorance, of the famine that was taking place at the time. But on the other hand, he really does tell the story about how whatever's going on there is America's fault pretty damn well, too. So, and in fact, on page 222 of his book, he quotes the State Department goon saying, "Oh, we wanted to keep Sheikh Sharif all along anyway. We just wanted to take him down a peg." Yeah, that's why they killed 250,000 people in this horrible war and led to the rise of al-Shabaab, madmen and all the rest of this. It was because they wanted to take Sheikh Sharif down a peg or two. They didn't even want to get rid of him. So, I mean, that to me is the ultimate indictment. They had to all be doing 1,000 years in prison for that.
We had an earlier smokescreen. It was called the Darfur Genocide. And
right.
See, the Darfur Genocide was something that was created by mainly pro-Israel Zionist organizations in the West, and it raised at least $100 million, claiming to help the victims of the Darfur Genocide, and I haven't been able to find any evidence that any of that money, that $100 million, ever made it to anybody in Darfur. But the fact was, the fighting in Darfur took place mainly in 2003, 2004. By the time, maybe 20 or 30,000 people died, a real tragedy, but no genocide. By the time these Western pro-Zionist, pro-Israel organizations started raising the hue and cry of the Darfur Genocide, the fighting had already over. And yet they demonized the president of Sudan, who was actually credited by all the UN staffers from Darfur that I've ever spoken to with playing an active role in actually preventing mass starvation. If it wasn't for the cooperation and support of Omar al-Bashir, that the most successful relief project in history, which was the largest most successful relief project in history, which is the Darfur relief effort, would not have been possible. All along in Ethiopia, the real genocide was going on. Mm. And who was covering all this up? Well, you know, takes us back to the Obama White House. We've got people like Gail Smith. Now, have you ever heard of Gail Smith?
Only from you.
Yeah, and yet if you Google her name on the internet, you come up with she's a senior foreign policy advisor to Obama on Africa and foreign aid. And she, Tony Lake, and Susan Rice were senior foreign policy advisors to Obama in his campaign. The payoff to Anthony Lake was he got head of UNICEF, the failed nominee to head of the CIA, became head of the organization of the world. And Susan Rice went on to become ambassador to the UN and then now national security advisor to Obama. But Gail Smith is the quiet consigliere. Mm-hmm. And she's the one that's behind the scenes. She's the senior advisor to Obama. She's the big sister to Susan Rice. Susan Rice's actual godmother, really, literally godmother, was Madeleine Albright. But her big sister that guided her from her days in the Clinton administration as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs was Gail Smith, who went from a career as a supposedly award-winning journalist in the Horn of Africa, who actually lived in the trenches with the Marxist-Leninist Enver Hoxhaite Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which is now the ruling party in Ethiopia, and was actually the mistress of one of their fighters named guerrilla fighters, Dom Daguerre's name was Jamaica. I mean, she was so down in the trenches that she won the admiration of her at the top levels of the U.S. intelligence community. That in 1991, she was given an award as a journalist, and 3 years later, in 1994, she became the chief of staff of the Agency for International Development. Now, how do you go from being a journalist in 3 years to being head of the chief operating officer of the largest U.S. multi-billion-dollar aid agency, Agency for International Development, which has actually just recently been in the spotlight because they were trying to destabilize the Cuban government through their AIDS awareness program in Cuba. So she, the 3 years from a journalist to head of USAID, I mean, that should give you an idea that this woman had it was, she caught the attention of the top members of the U.S. Intelligence Community. And by 1998, 4 years later, she was the head of the African desk for the National Security Council under Bill Clinton and under Tony Lake. So this woman today now sits in the White House, just down the hall from Obama. And before Obama does anything, he calls Gail Smith in and says, Mike Consigliere, what should we do about these problems in Africa? Or Mike Consigliere, what should we do about these foreign aid programs we're going to use to destabilize countries around the world? And this woman, nobody's ever heard of. And, I've been overdue to write an article about her because she's someone that nobody knows about, and yet she's a darling of the liberal establishment. Yeah. When she was, after her time in the trenches of the Clinton administration, she went after, I think it's the Center for American Progress or something like that. I mean, she was darling of the liberal society, and now she's back in the White House, one of those that was the little pushers behind the scenes for this big disaster in Libya. The one that knows full well because the organization spoke about the genocide in Ogaden when she was in opposition to the Bush regime. Mm-hmm. And now she's doing her best to raise smoke screens and other things, try to keep anybody from talking about the real genocide that's going on in Ethiopia. So, I think that's something your listeners ought to look into. It's interesting that her personal biographical information and how she went from a journalist to being head of chief of staff of USAID in 3 years is no longer available on her website.
Well, when I Googled her, I'm really falling down on the job here, Thomas. I Googled her. It says here her official title is Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director of the National Security Council. So, I should know everything about this lady and what she's up to, not just her background, but what she's up to. I will note that it's hilarious that her latest blog entry is from January 2013, and it's about more humanitarian aid for the Syrian rebels.
Well, this woman got up at Meles Zenawi's funeral and eulogized him and talked about him. And I saw this on Ethiopian TV, which we have on satellite here, and via satellite. And she got up and talked about how she'd been good friends with Meles Zenawi for over 30 years. Now we're talking about going back into the early 1980s, back when Meles Zenawi was a guerrilla fighter off in the trenches of the Sahel Desert fighting the Soviet-backed Derg regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam. And so she's like, good bosom buddies eulogizing this Meles Zenawi that's committing genocide in the Ogaden and sitting right next to Barack Obama, who is son of an African from Kenya. So, I had an article a few years back. You can start with that. I think it's called From Guerrilla Mistress to Obama Confidant, The Life and Crimes of Gail Smith. And I'm about to come out with another one that's called Obama's Quiet Consigliere. Mm. And how this woman that eulogized, she's praised, effluent praise of Meles Zenawi at his funeral. She and Susan Rice were both there sitting in the front row praising one of the worst dictators Africa's ever known. And, this is the liberal establishment in the United States, that drives so much of us progressive revolutionary forces to close alliances with libertarians because the liberals can't be trusted. And I mean, when I say liberals can't be trusted, I have to include at times even people who do such good work as Amy Goodman, because Democracy Now! Went on and on about the Darfur genocide, and I've never heard of them ever doing a program about the genocide in the Ogaden. So, you know, it's like, I don't personally, I don't trust liberals.
That's
just my opinion.
If this is what the revolutionaries are like when they take power, just DLC, Hillary Clinton Democrats, that's pretty damn dangerous. I wanted to ask you, too, real quick here, Thomas, about the new dictator of Ethiopia ever since Zenawi died there. Who is he and how bad is he?
Yeah, well, he is like a flunky that had no... Melis Zenawi handpicked the guy, Haile Mariam Desalegn, because he was no threat. He had no basis in power, and he could provide no threat. And Melis Zenawi picked him shortly after the United States dumped Mubarak. And Mubarak was a loyal servant to the United States policy for all those decades. And Melis Zenawi saw how quickly the United States disposed of him. So the Melis Zenawi, apparently he was sick. He had a brain tumor. And he knew that his time was up, and he knew that the United States might want to get rid of him. So he set up as his deputy, somebody nobody had ever heard of, had a master's degree in public sanitation from someplace, and he's the new prime minister of Ethiopia. And he's sort of like a compromise candidate because the pack of hyenas that Melis Zenawi is surrounded by, who was his former comrade in arms in the guerrilla movement called the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the ethnic group that Melis Zenawi is from, one of the smallest, most despised ethnic groups in Ethiopia, but who succeeded to power after the Eritrean army, guerrilla army, overthrew the Soviet-backed Mengistu regime in 1991. Now these Tigrayan hyenas, that each of them want to have power, and like any pack of hyenas, if one hyena runs in to pick a bite of Haile Mariam Desalegn, the other hyenas will bite them from the back. So they sort of have a compromised candidate that they're letting sort of be the front man while they sort of circle and see who's going to be the chief hyena that eventually wants to come to power. But see, the reality is the situation in Ethiopia is so unstable that the United States has had to step in. And this is something I really would hope that the latest Snowden revelations would expose more, because we'd heard in the WikiLeaks revelations that how the United States has been involved in a lot of scandalous activities in support of the Ethiopians, are fully aware of crimes the Ethiopians are committing, and they're blaming the Eritreans and others for. Because what I wanted to know was, you know, the role of the CIA in Ethiopia, because I have had an article based upon reports that many of the high-ranking Ethiopian officials have been complaining about the fact that they can't make any decisions without consulting the white man down the hall in the CIA office, and that the CIA has basically been setting a lot of policy in Ethiopia. And the fact is, see, there's been a series of high-level assassinations of leading members of the Ethiopian resistance, whether they're in the new Tigrayan resistance or among the Ogaden fighters. There's been some very disastrous assassinations, not just of key leaders, but oftentimes majority of the central committee of these resistance organizations. And, you know, something that ought to give people pause about what's going on in South Sudan is that recently, Ban Ki-moon, the head of the UN, nominated the former head of the Ethiopian military intelligence to head the South Sudanese quote-unquote peacekeepers of the UN. And this general formerly had been head of the 10,000-man Ethiopian quote-unquote peacekeepers that had been occupying the oil fields on the border between North and South Sudan. These Ethiopian peacekeepers who have been so blatant about arming the rebels of Riek Machar that UN staff even held a press conference last year to denounce the destabilizing acts of the Ethiopian peacekeepers in Sudan, which should have tipped everybody off that Ethiopia was behind Riek Machar, but somehow everybody even missed all that. So the head of the Ethiopian, former head of Ethiopian military intelligence, is now head of so-called peacekeepers in South Sudan. And this is the guy that was assassination death squads that was going out and killing the people in the resistance movement.
So, you know, I've kept you way over time here, and the phone bill is going to completely bankrupt me, man. I better stop it now, Thomas.
Hey, man, your listeners got to come through. Your listeners got to come through, Scott. Great to be back on the show, man.
Thank you, Thomas.
See you again someday.
I sure appreciate it.
Okay, ciao.
All right. That's Thomas Mountain, everybody, reporting from Eritrea. And he writes for counterpunch.org. That's where you can find him most often. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.